Word on Today FM.
Around this time last year on the Culture Club, we had Willie White with us, and for the Dublin Theatre Festival was just coming up. And not long after we had him on the Culture Club, he decided to announce his retirement from the role. So we're delighted that his successor is with us today. Rosha Gone, you're very welcome to The Last Word and to the Culture Club.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
You took over as chief executive and artistic director back in February. So that's a relatively short run, isn't it, to put in together this year's festival, which starts on the 25th of September.
It was. It was a bit of a, a hectic kind of start. But, you know, there's nothing like being thrown in at the deep end to get you going. So it's been a whirlwind, but it's been great fun.
So on from the 25th of September to the 12th of October, and before we go to your Culture Club choices, tell us what you're bringing to this year's Dublin Theatre Festival. What can we expect?
Well, the great thing about Dublin Theatre Festival is that we are the premier destination for audiences to see the best of international theatre once a year. This is the moment where you can see all of the shows that are touring the major festivals internationally. And it's my job, my very lucky job, that I get to travel around these festivals and pick the best of them and invite them to Dublin for the festival. So we have an extraordinary selection of international shows. First among them, we're opening the festival with a really amazing production of Hamlet by a Peruvian theatre company called Teatro La Plaza. And they are they have this really unique take on Hamlet, where the show is performed by an ensemble of actors who all have Down syndrome. And I think that the particular lens of their life experience that they bring to this production is really extraordinary. I didn't know what to expect going in to see this show. I just heard that it was really extraordinary. And I went to see it and I was just so moved, so captivated, and really felt like I understood Hamlet in a new way, like, and maybe really understood Hamlet properly for the first time after seeing this production. So that's a really great one. We're bringing Tir Warshawa, who are one of the most incredible acting ensembles from anywhere in the world, based in Poland. And it's their fourth time coming to Dublin. They haven't been in a long time, though. And their show, Pieces of a Woman, is one of the most kind of urgent and exciting shows that's on the international touring circuit at the moment. And it's a kind of a family dinner. You're brought into this world of this family dinner, three generations of a family, where lots of kind of dirty laundry comes out of the wash at this family dinner in a really extraordinary and gripping performance by an incredible ensemble of actors. And then as well as that, we've got really fantastic Irish shows in the mix. We have the premiere of a new work by Shane O'Reilly called Her Father's Voice, which I just can't stop talking to people about because it's just so exciting. And this is a show about, again, it's kind of a family drama. It's about a family, three generations also of a family that are living under one roof, where the youngest member of the family is about to undergo a cochlear implant surgery. And the show kind of presents an ethical dilemma around deaf culture, non-deaf culture, and how a family that includes deaf people and non-deaf people deal with this topic, one that I think is dealt with such sensitivity and nuance, and kind of makes the audience question what we think, you know, what we think the right choices are, and how we determine a kind of like, you know, where the moral spirit level is, I think, within our families, in our communities. And this play really shakes at that center and kind of asks us to ask ourselves questions about sometimes, I suppose, the damage that doing, quote unquote, the right thing can do. So that's a really exciting one as well. I could go on, Matt, and tell you about...
Well, I know there's loads on DublinTheatreFestival.ie website. There are still tickets available for some performances of various plays, are there?
Yeah, for lots. I mean, Caligula, the Ukrainian production we have, is pretty much sold out. And Three Sisters, which is an exciting new production of the Chekhov play that stars Saoirse Monica Jackson, Alex from The Young Offenders, and Mairead Tyers, and a bunch of other really extraordinary actors. That's also selling extremely fast. But I'd encourage people to check out maybe something that they haven't seen before, or a company that they don't know about, because as I say, these are extraordinary shows from all over the world and Irish premieres that people haven't had a chance to see before. So I'd encourage people to, you know, move a little bit outside their comfort zone and choose something different.
Now, Rocha, we always start the Culture Club with music. We'll get back to theatre later when we're asking you about your choices. We always ask everybody to nominate the first piece of music they remember buying, usually a single. You don't have one for me, though. Did you come to music late?
No, I didn't. I talked about the first album I bought was Joni Mitchell's Blue when I was 12 or 13. But actually, I'm sorry, maybe I came at this wrong. I mean, the one I remember buying in the shop is Live Aid when I was about 3 or 4, being brought to the shop to buy the single of that one.
Do they know it's Christmas?
Yeah, do they know it's Christmas? Yeah, I was 4, and I think it was my kind of the present that I was given by my aunt and uncle, because my brother had just been born. My brother was born on the 20th of December, and it was right before Christmas. And I think I was feeling a bit put out by the arrival of. and my aunt and uncle brought me to HMV, and I think we bought the single of Do They Know It's Christmas. But I suppose in my, and I kind of, that memory just came flooding back to me when I think about like my first real album that I felt this great sense of ownership of. It's definitely Joni Mitchell's Blue.
Okay, tell us why.
I think because of a sense of, I suppose I was a very emo early teenager. Like I hit my emo age, like kind of around 11, 12. And I was very busy reading like, you know, Jane Eyre and the works of the Bronte sisters, and feeling a little bit like the world didn't understand me. And I think for girls who feel like the world maybe doesn't quite understand them, Joni Mitchell's music is a place where you kind of venture in adolescence and you stay there in life, because she's such an extraordinary artist that you always find something new. And when I was about 12 or 13, I just remember hearing like the first lines of I am on a lonely road and I am traveling, which is from the first song, All I Really Want, on that album Blue, and feeling immediately captivated. And like, this artist is an artist for me, because she understands what it is to feel, I suppose, a little bit outside the main, and to kind of want to be in the gang, but also not want to be in the gang. And I was just so captivated by her voice and her lyrics, and the kind of ambition of her music and her voice, and also knowing that she was so young as well when she wrote that album, and feeling like, you know, Joni got me. And I guess I still feel Joni gets me as a 40-something-year-old woman now.
Let's hear a little bit from the Blue album, the track This Is California.
Oh, it gets so lonely when you're walking and the streets are full of strangers. All the news on your ear just give you the blues. Caught a plane to Spain, went to a party down a red dirt road. There were lots of pretty people there, reading Rolling Stone, reading Vogue. They said, how long can you hang around? I said, a week, maybe two, just until my skin turns brown. And I'm going home to California, California. I'm coming home. Oh, will you take me as I am, strung out on another man.
Joni Mitchell from an album Blue, which actually, Rocha, has come up many times over the years on the Culture
so
Club
generic.
As favourites. Yeah, Joni Mitchell's lyrics, the singing, everything about us, she has so many fans. still.
She's amazing.
Now, we asked you for a favourite band, and we're allowing you to do what you've done because you've given us a journey effectively through your life, in that you say you can't pick one, and I can understand that. But you've given us what your teen years were, the 20s, the 30s, into your 40s. So take it away. I'm delighted to have all of these particular bands mentioned. Go back to your teenage years.
Well, it's maybe somewhat embarrassing. I think maybe it is a little bit embarrassing because of their politics now, but I was a very big Take That fan. And I remember also around the time, I guess when you're a person now, like, it makes sense to me now as a person who works in the arts with a very eclectic taste, that I was able to hold kind of like Joni Mitchell in the one hand and the traditional music that was very much part of my culture at home and the house that I grew up in on the other, and that I was at school able to kind of live in indie land. And then I was also able to inhabit the space of a slightly crazed early teenage Take That fan. I remember just being so captivated by like the mythology of Take That, as well as how cute I thought they were, and how much I enjoyed their music, and how much I enjoyed kind of listening to that music with my other gal pals, being mildly obsessed with Take That. So it kind of they were the first kind of boy band that I came to, and then luckily enough I was able to spring out of that and around the kind of time of the kind of Britpop Blur versus Oasis, I was very firmly in the Blur camp.
So did you go and see Oasis when they came to Croke Park last weekend?
I did not. I mean, I heard it was great, and like, well done everyone for...
but you're loyal to Blur.
I'm loyal to Blur, and I have seen them many times actually over the years. Like I went to see them when I was 15, in this brilliant gig that they did at the RDS. And then I saw them when they... I saw them in Hyde Park when they just started doing the kind of new reunion tours around like maybe the early 2010s. And then I saw them when they were at IMA then a couple of years later. So I've seen them a bunch of times. And I think also I've enjoyed all of the music that Damon Albarn has produced in his different guises, like at Gorillaz, obviously, but also the amazing Mali music album he made many moons ago, and some of his later forays also into the world of like opera and collaborating with theatre artists. He made an amazing theatre show at the Manchester International Festival about 15 years ago, which I still remember very clearly. It was fantastic. So I always kind of follow him and follow them and their music, and have enjoyed that a lot.
Yeah, and I see you mentioned Radiohead and the Fugees from that decade as well. And then into your 20s, Destiny's Child, Gossip and Anthony and the Johnsons.
Oh, like all of the above, you know, that's the thing. I have a very eclectic taste. Love a bit of pop, love my kind of soulful music, and Anoni's music. I think still that Anthony and the Johnsons album it's like it takes me into my early 20s in a way that very few pieces of music do. And I love what Anoni does today. You've got to love a bit of Destiny's Child. I remember being, when I was on my J1 in California, listening to a lot of Destiny's Child, having a great time. And then at the same time, Beth Ditto is a kind of constant hero for me. So the Gossip were a big part of my 20s and music that I enjoyed.
Yeah, and I see Blur come in your 20s, and they come in your 30s with LCD Sound System. But we're going to pick one of your choices as you got a little older into your 40s, Lancome. Before you tell us why Lancome are your choice, let's hear a little bit of The New York Trader from the album False Lancome.
Thank you.
Now, that's Lancome. So tell us why you've chosen Lancome as your favourite band from, I suppose, the current day.
Well, I guess I grew up really steeped in traditional music. My mother is a singer. My aunt and uncle are traditional musicians as well. And it's that sense of like the band has always been a big influence on my life. And I think it's really great seeing, you know, I guess, being a little bit older and seeing a generation of people who maybe wouldn't have come to traditional music find a home with Lancome and find something new there, and also something find very familiar there. And I guess I also, in the waves of kind of traditional music becoming cool again for more mainstream audiences, which is happening the same way as an Irish speaker, you know, about every 5 years, somebody comes to me and is like, wants, you know, to talk about the fact that the Irish language has suddenly become cool. And it's like, wow, this is the 10th time I've had this conversation. I think in this current wave of like kind of traditional music and Gaelic culture being cool again, I think Lancome are doing something really, really old and really new at the same time, and doing it in a really beautiful way. And I think that the kind of like, the kind of mood of Lancome and the kind of darkness of their music is such an interesting reflection of these times that we're living in. And I find like that even in the kind of gloom of it, there is often a kind of a sense of hope and defiance in their music that I find really like really motivating. Do you know, like sometimes I'm when you're looking out the window and it's a bit gloomy and storm clouds are brewing, I'd be listening to Lancome and I'd be thinking about like, through kind of stormy times come possibility and come new things. And I think that's what their music offers. Sorry, that might sound a little bit highfalutin, but I think there's a lot of light in the darkness of their music.
Love that. Okay, tell us about a favourite gig. You've gone for Bjork.
Yeah, I was, again, I'm thinking about that festival, that edition of Manchester International Festival in 2011, which stands out as one of my kind of greatest arts festival experiences, just in terms of the theatre, the visual art, the music and the dance that I saw at that festival that year. It was really quite incredible. And that was the beginning of Björk's Biophilia project. And she subsequently toured that show and made an album, and then later made a kind of visual album from Biophilia. But she did this, the kind of initial series of concerts happened at Manchester International Festival, and they happened in an old fruit market in the city. And like, if you imagine, if you were in, you know, for Dubliners maybe listening, if you were in the fruit market at Smithfield, that's what the feeling was, is that you were in an old market that has been closed for a while and feels a little bit kind of maybe unloved and uncherished. And within that context, you were seeing like this extraordinary artist and this beautiful way of presenting a gig. The gig was presented in the round, so the audience was on all sides of her and she was in the middle of the stage, and there were a series of kind of video screens with these like video images of organic materials, and she was and flowers and fauna and these kind of things. And then she was accompanied on the stage by this choir of Icelandic women, and the energy of the gig was just unlike anything I'd experienced before. Like, it was just incredible. And like, I was a Björk fan before, but I had never seen her live. And and the power that she had over the audience, and also the way that she kind of like, you know, the way that she told a story, I guess a bigger story, like a bigger story beyond the kind of songs that she was singing with the gig, was just unlike anything I'd experienced before.
Let's hear a little bit, because we do have from the live album released in 2014, Crystalline.
Crystals grow like plants.
That is Bjork Crystalline from the Biophilia tour and gig. Movies. And you've given us a list of movies which suggest you like a really good, feel-good, sit-down Sunday afternoon, Sunday evening movie.
Yes, I do. I spend a lot of time at the theatre where things are very complicated and where I go and see a lot of theatre. And often when I go to the cinema, I just want to be entertained.
And you've gone with things in movies like Strictly Ballroom, Tootsie, The Princess Bride, which has come up a few times in this, All About Eve, All About My Mother, When Harry Met Sally, Moonstruck. Yeah, real 80s and 90s fare there.
Yeah, I just love it. Like, I guess those things are the things you come back to. When I think about what I guess the difference is, I answer the question, what's your favourite movie, rather than what do you think is the best movie?
Oh, that's what we asked.
Yeah, like that's the thing, is they're the movies that I come back to again and again. I do think Moonstruck is like, have you seen Moonstruck recently, Matt?
No, like, this Moonstruck was Cher, isn't it?
It's with Cher and she's fantastic. She was nominated, in fact, she won an Oscar for it. And it's Cher and Nicolas Cage. And Nicolas Cage does some overacting that's so intensely fantastic that like it's you just won't believe it. It's so good. But she is so she's so real. And the story of this movie, it's set in the, like, also it's, you know, it's a Manhattan that we... that's kind of lost, you know, it's set in the Italian American community of Manhattan. She's this woman who's kind of like, she's going to get married to this guy. She's not really into it. She's living at home with her family in this intergenerational family home. You know, she's kind of an awkward woman. Like, she's not really, she doesn't really conform to the status quo. And she's an accountant and she travels around these local businesses kind of doing their books. And she's engaged to this guy and she's going to marry him. She agrees that he'll to marry him before he goes off to say goodbye to his dying mother in Italy. And while he's away, she visits his estranged brother, and who is played by Nicolas Cage. And they have this kind of wildly unexpected connection that happens between them, like a bolt of lightning, like she's literally moonstruck. And it's just such an enjoyable story. It's such an unexpected story. The script is so good. The script is written by John Patrick Shanley, and we'll forgive him for his later sins, like Wild Mountain Time, which is truly bizarre film. But the script for Moonstruck is just so tight. The dialogue is so excellent. It's the kind of movie where you like stop and rewind. If you're watching it on the telly, like you stop and you rewind it because the lines are so good. You want to hear them again. I cannot recommend it highly enough, particularly to people, I think, maybe who are a little bit younger and like who missed it. If you want to have a really great experience watching a film, check out Moonstruck.
And you've gone for a favourite actor. It's Allison Janney, who would be known to many people as CJ in The West Wing, but has been in lots of other things as well, particularly movies like The Hours.
Yeah, well, I mean, she's a relatively small part in The Hours. She plays Meryl Streep's kind of long-suffering partner in The Hours, and she's kind of in the background being fabulous. But yeah, I mean, I love
Allison Janney. Tonya? I mean, when she plays the mother.
She's incredible. She plays the mom. I think her best of those kind of like camp over the top roles that she plays, the best one I think is in Drop Dead Gorgeous, which is another cult classic, an all time favorite movie of mine. I've seen it very many times. And she plays the mother's best friend. And she's just so funny in it. And what I love about Allison Janney is that she can play these really deep, soulful roles. She can play these every woman characters like CJ Craig, which I think anybody who's watched The West Wing, you know, everybody wants to be CJ or kind of aspires to have the kind of sensitivity and smarts and good humor of CJ. But then when you see her playing these really extra over the top funny characters, I just think she's such an every woman. And it's really great to see her get her flowers now. Like a couple of weeks ago, she was given the Lifetime Achievement Award at the Las Culturistas Awards. And which is kind of a jokey award ceremony, you know, that's run by Bo and Yang Matt, I forget his surname. But anyway, they have a podcast called Las Culturistas and they do these awards. And she was given the Lifetime Achievement Award. And I was genuinely so moved because like She actually does have such an extraordinary career of really interesting performances. She's also done some interesting work in the theatre, although she's mostly a film and TV actress. I just love her range.
Well, you've covered the West Wing in television. I believe you still like Sex and the City. The original, is it, rather than the remakes?
I do. Yeah, but I actually, like, and I, like everyone else, kind of derided and enjoyed kind of hate watching and just like that. But I was listening to a podcast of the New York Times. There's one of their cultural critics, Wesley Morris, had the amazing Taffy Achner Brodesser. I don't know if you know her. She writes amazing profiles for the New York Times, and she also is a novelist. She wrote a book called Fleischman is in Trouble, and another one called Long Island Compromise, which are both excellent books. But she's also a brilliant cultural commentator, and they were on his podcast Cannonball, which is a New York Times podcast, and they were kind of saying, they were kind of in defense of And Just Like That. And her theory is that Taffy's theory is that And Just Like That is a really good documentary of the concerns of late middle-aged rich women who live in the Upper East Side of New York, which is kind of terrifying. But I think actually, in a way, like, they were asking questions around why are middle-aged women so embarrassing for the culture, which I think was, it gave me pause. But I do think that the original Sex and the City is a great series, and it's one I always go back to.
And I want to get to your current choice. I'm conscious of the time and the fact that we'll be coming up to 7 o'clock. So Slow Horses is your current favourite, I believe.
Slow Horses. Gary Oldman in Slow Horses. I mean, has anyone farted with such extraordinary skill as Gary Oldman in Slow Horses? It's just such a brilliant, gripping series. I adore it.
It is terrific. Books. Do you get time to read?
I do a bit, not as much as I'd like. I would quite like to spend more time reading. I have a big stack of books beside the bed that I'm slowly making my way through. At the moment, I've got Chimamanda Adichie's new book that I'm about to start. But I think historically, like, Everything is Illuminated by Jonathan Safran Foer is a book I come back to again and again and again. And I think I might have mentioned one of Paula Meehan's books, The Solace of Artemis. Did I mention
you
that?
You did.
One?
You did. Yeah, and another one that you gave us is Claire Keegan's Small Things Like These, which of course was adapted into the movie.
And that's the thing is if you don't have time to read, the great thing about Claire Keegan is her books are always so concise, but have such extraordinary worlds within them. So I've had great time reading everything that Claire Keegan has written in recent years. And Small Things Like These, I think I've read it 3 times. It's just so evocative and moody. And the film is great, but the book is just so extraordinary.
Well, we've only got 2 minutes left, so I need to bring you back to your favourite play or theatre or musical experience. What are you going to give us?
I think the best is maybe the most recent. So I had the great fortune of seeing Florentina Halsinger's Sancta at the Berliner Festspiele a couple of months ago. And like seeing a show where you've got things that you would perceive as so scandalous in an Irish
theatre
context.
Give us the list. Go on, don't be shy about it.
There are acts of live sex happening on the stage. There are like scores of naked performers. There is, because in the show she kind of recreates all the major moments of the Catholic sacraments. So there is a moment where some flesh is extracted from one of the performers' bodies. It is then fried.
Hold on a second. This isn't live cannibalism, is it?
It is live cannibalism. Well, I mean, it's a small section of flesh is fried and then subsequently eaten by another performer on stage. But it's done with such joy. Like, I mean, there was a lot of scandal about it. There was a lot of newspaper coverage internationally about this scandalous piece of theatre. The thing is when you're in the audience and watching it, it's such great crack. And it's not just great crack in an immediate sense. Like, I think about that show months later and I'm finding new thoughts, new ideas.
Have you brought that to the Dublin Theatre Festival?
I hope to bring it to the Dublin Theatre Festival. We need to build some resilience.
Okay, it has been great having you on. I'm sorry we haven't got the chance to get to all your choices. But Rosha Gowan, Chief Executive and Artistic Director of the Dublin Theatre Festival, thank you so much for being with us. And of course, the festival is running from the 25th of September to the 12th of October. And if you want information as to what tickets are available for what particular plays, then go to dublintheatrefestival.ie.
The Last Word on Today FM.